All right. Well, Shabbat Shalom. Welcome to everybody online, which is pretty much everybody. The neighbors decided to come over and sneak in the back door away from the germs upstairs. Everybody went to bed last night feeling, I guess, okay. She kind of felt like it might be coming on, but she felt pretty good during the day and made the meal and everything. And so then this morning I got up and she was not feeling very well, but she is feeling a little better as the day wears on. So hopefully she can kick it quickly. All right. Well, we're going to jump back into our series today. Of course, we're looking at the words that were directly spoken by God in the First Testament. I've put a fresh look to the slides. My plan is to continue this series, but not just like every week. I'm going to break it up with other messages as well. So this next year is going to be like the proverbial box of chocolates. You never know what you're going to get. Today, though, will be all about the Jubilee and its impact on Israel and on our individual spiritual journeys. Even that word sounds wonderful, doesn't it? Jubilee. We can all use some Jubilee in our lives from time to time, right? We find the Jubilee in Leviticus and chapter 25, which is where we left off in the series, clear back in August, believe it or not. While the word Jubilee sounds really upbeat with celebration and festivity, the Jubilee of Leviticus 25 is somewhat somber for some, while being very welcomed to come around for others. For many, it was an unwelcome, severe interruption in their lives that carries with it not just a little bit of discomfort and inconvenience, but also, in many cases, loss of personal prosperity as well. This 25th chapter of Leviticus contains much civil law regarding property, particularly when that property is either land or slaves. And this is important to be able to understand what is given here for a couple of reasons. One, we get important understanding about the backdrop of the times, biblical times. And second, it contains principles and patterns that not only give us direction on how we should think and behave as it relates to property, but also on certain functions of the priesthood of our Messiah. I think most of all of us have probably read this chapter. So I'm not going to read the whole thing, but I do want to start with one of these sections, and then we can refer to other sections as we go along. But here in verses 8 through 17, it says this, that you shall count seven Sabbaths of years for yourselves, seven times 7 years, and the time of the seven Sabbaths of years shall be to you 49 years. Then you shall cause the trumpet of the Jubilee to sound on the 10th day of the 7th month, on the Day of Atonement. You shall make the trumpet to sound throughout all your land. And you shall consecrate the 50th year and proclaim liberty throughout all the land to all its inhabitants. It shall be a Jubilee for you, and each of you shall return to his possession, and each of you shall return to his family. That 50th year shall be a Jubilee to you. In it you shall neither sow nor reap what grows of its own accord, nor gather the grapes of your untended vine. For it is the Jubilee. It shall be holy to you. You shall eat its produce from the field. In this year of Jubilee, each of you shall return to his possessions. And if you sell anything to your neighbor or buy from your neighbor's hand, you shall not oppress one another. According to the number of years after the Jubilee, you shall buy from your neighbor. and in according to the number of years of crops he shall sell to you. According to the multitude of years you shall increase its price, and according to the fewer number of years you shall diminish its price. For he sells to you according to the number of the years of the crops. Therefore you shall not oppress one another, but you shall fear your God. I am the Lord your God. So from the 40,000 foot view here, the Jubilee is about restoration. It's about mercy. In a supreme divine demonstration of God's grace towards his people. But you also quickly notice that he involves the people in this. They have these parallel acts of restoration that they have to conduct, that they have to institute, they have to walk out. That is to say that God has given instructions that demonstrate his attitude of perfect and ideal justice. For him, it's about fairness. It's about equality. It's about mercy and redemption. But, as are all his laws, they're not just something to think about and feel good about. They are to be followed. They are to be physically observed. They are to do this. God is causing his attributes of grace, mercy, and justice to be manifested into the physical realm. He is showing them how the rubber meets the road in this idea of loving your neighbor as yourself. In these instructions, we see that restoration and mercy are carried out by means of regulations and ordinances involving property rights, both from the standpoint of what is best for a clan or a family collectively, or as an individual, protecting that individual as well. Another primary purpose of the Jubilee laws was to assure that any reasonably diligent man who found himself and or his family in poverty for any number of reasons would have the opportunity for a fresh start. The usual reason for this was debt. I mean, when you know, debt leads to poverty. And for the Hebrew, the usual reason many wound up in indebted servitude to another Hebrew was due to a debt that he could not pay. Now, whether or not you've ever experienced that doesn't matter. I think we can all relate to that. That once you get started down this rabbit hole of debt, it's very difficult to dig your way back out of it. And many times, the beginning of that slope into debt. It is caused from things that are, you know, possibly outside your control. Health issues, natural disasters, maybe the sudden death of a key breadwinning family member, on and on. One can find themselves under the crushing burden of debt and become bankrupt. In our society in America and around the world, the debt comes in two ways. It comes in unsecured debt, like credit cards and that kind of thing, and secured debt. Secured debt meaning that there's collateral, like your house or your car. If you fail to make enough, you know, payments on your mortgage, they repossess the house. Same with the car. You get too far behind, they come get the car. But in the Hebrew system, you have to understand there was no unsecured debt. It was all secured debt. And because it was mostly an agricultural society, the security in most cases was land. And the problem is, if you lose your land, you not only lose your house, but you also lose your your income. You lose your ability to be able to earn a living, to buy other things that you need, but other than the things that are being produced on the land. So the loss of land was debilitating. And once land was lost, the only other kind of security for a debt in that biblical Hebrew era was yourself or a member of your family or your whole family. And so this is where we get into this idea and this concept of indebted servitude. Unfortunately, it's translated in our Bibles as slavery. But it wasn't what we think of in our society today as slavery. It's not attached to that. In Hebrew society, a human being became collateral for the loan, became collateral for the debt, the way to pay back the debt. Not the human itself, but the labor that the human could perform and the value of that labor. The year of the Jubilee was partly designed to deal with these everyday realities of the loss of land and the loss of you having your own labor benefit you. So it was dealing with both land and labor. What I've read here so far dealt with the land. So I want to drop down now and see how God addressed the labor part. We're looking at verses 39 through 55. And if one of your brethren who dwells by you becomes poor and sells himself to you, you shall not compel him to serve as a slave. As a hired servant and a sojourner, he shall be with you and shall serve you until the year of Jubilee. And then he shall depart from you, he and his children with him. He shall return to his own family. He shall return to the possession of his fathers. For they are my servants. That's a key thing there. They're his. They're God's. When I brought out of the land of Egypt, they shall not be sold as slaves. You shall not rule over them with rigor, but you shall fear your God. And as for your male and female slaves, whom you may have from the nations that are around you, from them you may buy male and female slaves. Moreover, you may buy the children of the strangers who dwell among you and their families who are with you, which they beget in your land, and they shall become your property. And you may take them as an inheritance for your children after you, to inherit them as a possession. They shall be your permanent slaves. And these are, again, indentured servants. They're employees that in that sense. They're paid. But regarding your brethren, the nation of Israel, you shall not rule over one another with rigor. Now a sojourner or stranger close to you becomes rich, and one of your brethren who dwells by him becomes poor and sells himself to the stranger or sojourner close to you or to a member of the stranger's family, after he is sold, he may be redeemed again. One of his brothers may redeem him, or his uncle's son may redeem him, or anyone who is near of kin to him in his family may redeem him. If he is able, he may redeem himself. Thus he shall reckon with him who bought him. The price of his release shall be according to the number of years. From the year that he was sold to him until the year of Jubilee, it shall be according to the time of a hired servant for him. If there are still many years remaining according to them, he shall repay the price of his redemption from the money which he was bought. And if there remain but a few years until the year of Jubilee, then he shall reckon with him, and according to his years he shall repay him the price of his redemption. And so see, it's much like the land. It's the period of time. He shall be with him as a yearly hired servant, and he shall not rule with rigor over him in your sight. And if he is not redeemed in these years, then he shall be released in the year of Jubilee, he and his children with him. For the children of Israel are servants to me. They are my servants, whom I brought out of the land of Egypt. I am the Lord your God. I think it's pretty easy to see God's mercy in all of this. It's far and away different from what we think of when we hear this word slavery. These are indentured servants that were not captured and forced against their will for human labor. Much like the land was sold based on what it could produce from the time that it happened to the Jubilee, so it was for the people themselves needing to work and provide labor for another person in order to sustain their lives apart from the land inheritance that they were given. Now, I understand I've kind of read right through that. There's lots of nuances to that, and maybe we'll get to that next time, but that is the major focus here. Now, I know we have been away from this series for a while, and we need to understand that as we continue further into the words of Yehovah, that we are building on concepts. We are building on revelations already given. We are to read this in context with everything else that we've already been given. And within all that, He has and is revealing His character, His will, and His feelings towards His human creation. So again, we have to maintain this idea that we are peeling back the layers of an onion. You know, we have gone from the basics of God's law in Exodus, next to the initial parts of Leviticus that gave us more information, and then further we're building upon that too. You know, some of these subjects just keep getting brought up, and we get additional nuances into it. As you know, as we get into Numbers and Deuteronomy, we'll get even more information that connects more dots, and the people that have worked their way through the first three books get rewarded with some more information. So we've gone through a couple of grade levels, right? And so we're gaining a base of knowledge. And then God gives us more details. And one of those is this. When we think about the land that Abraham was granted, if you will, by God, it was not an outright transfer of ownership the way that we in our society think of owning things. God retained ownership of Canaan. It's His land. And instead, He gave Abraham's seed what we would consider to be a long-term lease. He gave them a lease. And as retaining ownership of that property under a lease, he has the right to say what the terms of that lease is. And he can evict them if he wants to, based on breaking the terms of that lease, something that he did, by the way, a few times. I want you to notice something back in verse 2. Speak to the children of Israel and say to them, when you come into the land which I give you, then the land shall keep a Sabbath to the Lord. Now the word give here is translated from the Hebrew word Nathan. N-A-T-H-A-N. Now, to those of you that have studied the life and times of King David, you'll recognize that as the name of the prophet who served King David. The sense of the word means this: bestowed, given, added, apportioned, gifted, assigned, or set apart. And so as you look at that list, you'll notice pretty quickly that it does not indicate any transfer of ownership. It's more that something has been assigned or set apart and apportioned to someone to have dominion over, to have stewardship over. Think of Yeshua's parable of the rich ruler that put control over cities in his kingdom and went off, and he said, "You watch over it. You take care of it." Well, those people that were put over those cities, they didn't own those cities. They managed them. They had control over them only in the sense that they were serving their master. It's a very fitting analogy here. And in the same way, we don't own anything. We don't own anything. We are given stewardship. It's the same with the land that Abraham was given and his descendants. They have possession of the land only in the same way as a lease, or even the same way we do here in the U.S. If you think that you own your house, you don't own your house. You have dominion over that house over and above any other citizen. But not over the government. Guess what? The government wants your house. We have the law of in eminent domain. And here they come and they'll take your house. Right? So, you sell it whether you want to or not. So, call the promised land a lease, or think of it in terms of eminent domain to the God of the universe. Either way, they didn't possess it in the way that we think of in terms of ownership. And it's a huge point. Yehovah retains ownership. Israel gets to use it only within the terms that he sets forth. Understanding this helps tremendously in contemplating the principles of Jubilee. In no way did anyone own the land. And of course, no one ever owns a person. They are only gaining the production of the land and the labor of the person for a time within the lease period, if that helps you. What Israel held in Joshua's day and holds today is not perpetual ownership of the land of Israel. Rather, they have a lease and lease terms. In Hebrew, this principle is called, and I can't pronounce it, you pronounce it in your head, but it means holding. So Yehovah tells Israel that since you do not own the land, you just have a lease on it, you can't sell the property. You can't sell it. Any of us who have ever leased a house or a building perfectly understands this. We use the property without interference from the owner as long as we honor the terms of the lease agreement. Right? One thing you can never do if you're leasing a house, you can't sell it because it's not yours. Now, what you can do, you can sublease it. But you can't sublease it past the term of the overall lease, right? So that's how it applies here, right? It is really a great reminder to us that we don't own anything. God does, and we are to be thankful for what He gives us stewardship over, what He gives us a lease on. Now then, taking this lease analogy further, every lease has provisions, doesn't it? Not only can't you sell it because it doesn't belong to you, but the landlord expects that whatever is being leased is utilized in accordance with the terms of the lease, with their wishes that they've, you know, done. I mean, we leased the house down the street so we'd have a place to live while we're building this one. Okay, in that lease, we could use the house for a primary residence for one family. It wasn't a multifamily dwelling. We had to maintain it. We had to, you know, not damage it. We had to keep up with all the utilities. We didn't have access to the shop. That was excluded. Okay, there were terms to the lease. In the same way, Yehovah set forth terms for leasing his land. I skipped over that part earlier. Let's read it now. Verses 3 through 7 says, 6 years you shall sow your field, and 6 years you shall prune your vineyard and gather its fruit. But in the seventh year there shall be a Sabbath of solemn rest for the land, a Sabbath to the Lord. You shall neither sow your field nor prune your vineyard. What grows of its own accord of your harvest you shall not reap, nor gather the grapes of your untended vine. For it is a year of rest for the land, and the Sabbath produce of the land shall be food for you. For you, your male and female servants, your hired man, and the stranger who dwells with you. For your livestock and the beasts that are in your land, all its produce shall be for food. So just as we had restrictions on how we could use that man's house up the street, Yehovah gave Israel restrictions on how they were to use his land. They could only cultivate it 6 out of the 7 years. It's his land and he wants it to rest. Now, one can fool around with the logic of this. You can look for the physical reasons for it, and you can try to wrap your mind around why God would do this and therefore give yourself some motivation for following. But the fact of the matter is that it doesn't matter, does it? Because it's Yehovah's land. And if he says... if he gives you a lease, and in that term of that lease, he says, well, you can only cultivate it 6 years, and the seventh one you don't touch it, then guess what? That's the rules. So for 6 years, the Israelites are to work the land. They're to work. They're to till it. They're to sow it and care for it. They're to harvest its produce. They're to prune the grapevines and harvest the grapes. But in that seventh year, which they called the sabbatical year, Israel was to do nothing with the land. They could not sow new grain crops. They could not even prune their vineyards. And pruning, supposedly, was the key for maintaining the health and productivity of the grapevines. In fact, they did it twice a year. One in the summer and another one in the fall. None of that was to occur during the Sabbath year. It's interesting, isn't it, that the discussion of the 50-year Jubilee cycle by Yehovah is precluded by this discussion of the 7-year rest of the land. It's reminding Israel, before even talking about the Jubilee, that the land that they are leasing, that they hold for him, is his. This is the foundation to understanding the Jubilee. Before I move on, I don't want you to get confused about verses 5 through 7 here. Because I realize that it seems like, on one hand, they say that during the seventh year, you can't harvest and eat what grows up naturally. And then on the other hand, it says you can harvest whatever the land produces by itself. This is kind of confused by language and translation, but it's clarified by history and context. Because they didn't glean the fields like we do, okay? It was very common for when the grain came up and ripened that seeds would fall out and go to the ground, and then they would naturally germinate themselves the next year, even if nothing happened. It also occurred that when they cut the grain stalks, that those stalks would sprout, the old stalks would sprout new growth. So there was a distinction then between the new growth of the seeds that fell. They couldn't touch that. But the old growth from the stalks they could touch that. And in fact, there were two different Hebrew words that made designation for that. I have them in my notes. I don't know how to pronounce them. The second growth from the stalks was called Safiach, S-A-F-I-A-C-H, and the third growth was called Sakish, S-H-A-C-H-I-S. I don't know how to pronounce them. But the fact is that you could not harvest the new grain from the seeds that fell, but you could go out and utilize, which they did, the grain from the second and the third sproutings of the old crop. Either way, the bottom line is that they could not eat the new stuff. They could do nothing in the way of cultivating or trying to cause that to happen either. That was a hands off. And I want you to also notice here that on the sabbatical year, notice that the lessee, the person that had control or stewardship of that piece of land, got no preferential benefit from it over and above anyone else. Because, again, the land is God's. And on that sabbatical year, anyone could come and get the grain that came up naturally, not the new stuff, but naturally they could get it. It was for everybody. Everything that was done in that seventh year was Yehovah's, and He gave it to everyone. This instruction, of course, points to the Sabbath. I mean, you think about it. In the wilderness, what happened with the manna? He gave the manna for 6 days, and on the seventh day, He didn't give it. And they had to completely rely on God to save over enough for, you know, the Sabbath. And it's the same thing. Israel, every 7 years, God, you know, Israel was being trained to rely on God to feed them, just like He fed them in the wilderness. They were not allowed to tend those fields for themselves. They had to fully rely on Yehovah to provide for them from His land. Every seventh year, God demonstrated to the Israelites that it was ultimately God that was providing sustenance, that was providing life from His ground. And Israel had to humble themselves every seventh year and simply wait on Yehovah to take care of them, just like the wilderness. If God didn't provide, they didn't eat. So a great deal of faith was required on the part of the Hebrews as the sabbatical year rolled around. And of course, since God did provide, it served to build trust in Him. Again, it's this basis then that God explains the Jubilee system. You should immediately recognize from the way that we count to Pentecost, the way that the Jubilee years were counted. It's the same thing. 7 times 7, 49, plus 1 is the 50th, and that 50th year, that it marks the beginning of that year on Yom Kippur, on the 10th day of Tishri in the 7th month on the Hebrew calendar. So why does the Jubilee start at that time instead of at the beginning of the actual calendar year in the first month? Well, we'd have to answer that question in terms of the physical implications as well as the spiritual ones. Hey, we're going to sing afterwards. Happy kids. First off, think about it from a physical standpoint. Okay, you've got the agricultural cycle, right? So you have the spring harvest, and you have this the fall harvest from the summer growth. So you have the winter growth and the summer growth. Well, the Day of Atonement is in the fall, right? They had just finished the summer growth and the fall harvest. And so then the work would have then turned at that point to preparing the fields and doing all the planting and everything for like the winter wheat and the winter season in preparation of the spring harvest. And then of course in the spring then there's that harvest and then going into the summer growth period and then the fall again. So you can see that the agricultural cycle started then. They were on the Day of Atonement restricted at that point from preparing for the next agricultural cycle of the spring and the fall harvests. Okay, so that makes sense from a physical standpoint. It's amazing then how this ties into what we understand on this side of Yeshua as the great spiritual meaning of the Jubilee. Okay? The prophetic implications of this are substantial. The 50th year, of course, connects with the 50th day of Pentecost, of Shavuot. The Lord told Israel that if they did not observe the 50th year of Jubilee, that they would be exiled from their land and foreigners would occupy it. And of course, that happened on more than one occasion. And this dovetails perfectly with Pentecost. Why? You know, it was done the same way. 7 times 7 plus 1 50th. And on that 50th day, the Holy Spirit came not just for the Jews, but for the Gentiles. Just like all the produce of the land on the seventh day was open to everyone. Even the sojourners that was among them. So, in the same way too, he said, if you don't celebrate the Jubilee, I'm going to exile you from the land. It's also said on Pentecost that if you don't accept the Spirit of God, you're basically not getting into the kingdom. You're exiled from the kingdom. So you can see the challenge. One would have to rest from all of their work. On those 6 years, you got to rest from your work and count only on the provisions of God. And it's the same with Pentecost. We are to lay aside our works and look to Yeshua to provide. But the challenge was that on the 50-year Jubilee, those who had riches, those who owned and owned land that was once owned by other people had to return it to their original owner. On Pentecost, we find that we must return all that we have to the original owner, to Yehovah. We are to die to ourselves. We are to present ourselves a living sacrifice. All our works that we produce with His land are His. And we are to rely solely on Him. Of course, Jubilee also points spiritually for us to atonement. Because that is when all of this comes to a point. It's on atonement that we come naked before the King. We come there naked to be judged. We're found guilty and we have to rely solely on the produce of His land, of Yeshua's Spirit in us to sustain us through that judgment with Him as our high priest. Without it, we perish. Just like the Israelites would in an agricultural society without means to work the land. They were not allowed to rely on their work, only the work of God on the land. Even though they were to work it diligently the other 6 years. Now then, if you worked out in your head the count to the 50th year in conjunction with the 7-year cycle, it may have occurred to you that the 49th year was a sabbatical year, and then the 50th year was also a sabbatical year. It was every 50 years there were 2 years straight. And then it took another year to grow crops. So 3 years. Now some Jews thought, well, this was too much, and so they tried to wiggle around it just like they tried to change the calendar to get away from having 2 Sabbaths in a row. But God's instructions here are very clear. The 49th year and the 50th year are both sabbatical years. So you think about that. 3 years without crops. God really wanted this lesson to be learned on that 50th year. He taught it every year through the counting like we do for Pentecost. And so we apply that lesson to Pentecost, but it really comes to bear on atonement. The pinnacle of the lesson. We live and we have our being in the physical because of what He provides. And we will live and have our being in the spirit realm because of what He provides. It's as simple as that. We rely on Him. We see and accept that which He is giving. He's giving His law and His blood. It's open to all, but as Yeshua said, in seeing they do not see, and in hearing they do not hear. Eyes and ears will be opened in the millennium, but for now many are shut, even while the offer is right there in front of them. There was talk at the feast, and even last Sabbath, about how to reconcile our needed response to God in working out our salvation. Working our fields during those 6 years. And as I was studying this, this made me think of an analogy that I believe illustrates the proper balance in this. Yehovah shows us clearly that the land and the produce of it are ultimately His. The produce of it is His. We are His. He forced the Israelites to stop their work on the 7th year. Their only work was to step back. And they were told to just wait on Him. Just like they were told when the Egyptian army was encroaching upon them at the shore of the Red Sea. And He said, stand and see the salvation of the Lord. Yet one would say that they did have to stand. And therefore they had a part in it. True enough. But there is more to it than that. I thought of an analogy that illustrates the heart of the matter. This is one of those analogies. Okay. This is one of those analogies that you have to hear with your heart and not your head. I'm asking for some grace here, and don't be thinking about how to punch holes in it or argue against it. Set that aside and hear the heart and the emotion that the lesson illustrates. Let's say that you're at the Grand Canyon. If you've never been there before, it is strikingly beautiful. And I'm going to say that this represents the world and all that it has to offer. You are living life and taking it all in. But you get a little bit close to the edge because it is so enticing. You want to take it all in. And you slip. You tumble over the edge and grasp onto a branch sticking out from the side of the sheer cliff. Something sort of like this, only I couldn't find with a man. You just have to pretend you're the big cat. There are literally 6,000 feet below you to the ground. It is 6,000 feet. I looked it up. In my analogy here, you are holding on to that branch, and the side of the cliff is completely unscalable. You can't climb up. All you can do is hang on. And when your physical energy, all that you can muster, when all of that is exhausted, you will certainly plunge to your death. The spiritual analogy, I know, is clear. It's pretty simple. the beauty of the world seduced you in getting even closer to the edge until you ultimately slipped and sinned. And now you are just hanging on to physical life. You could fall this afternoon, or maybe with your strength you hang on until you get your 4 score and 10 or even a little more. But eventually, no matter what you do, your physical power will be exhausted, and at some point, and despite all your effort, you will lose your grip on this life and plummet to your death. Now, continuing the analogy, imagine you're hanging there and a rope appears. You see it, but only because your eyes are opened, your ears are opened. You hear the one that threw it down say, "Grab the rope." Not everyone in this situation sees the rope, nor hears the call from the one above. But by an undeserved gift bestowed upon you by the grace of God Himself, there is something in your spirit, in you, that recognizes the call because of a gift. It's something that allows you to hear that voice, that trusts that you can transfer your energy from hanging on that branch to grasping the rope. In this analogy, the rope represents the law of God, the way to living eternally, not just hanging around waiting to die, but real living, abundant life. And of course, the one throwing the rope down is Yeshua. It makes sense. He's connected to the rope because He's the Word, the one that delivers the law. He is the Word, the giver of the law on Sinai, and the one that expounded upon it later. You wouldn't have the law, the rope to grasp onto and follow as works without Him providing it. And so He is there, able to throw it down. Why? Because He sacrificed His life, shed His blood, and being resurrected, He is there to throw you the rope. In faith, the gift that God gave you, in that pure faith and trust and nothing else, you let go of that branch and you grab the rope. And you hold on to that rope. It takes effort to hold on to that rope. There's no doubt about that. And we find as we hold on to that rope that many times our grip, you know, weakens a little bit, and you slide down some and you burn your hands and you burn your feet as you slide down and you have to grip it again. And we find ourselves sliding down to the bottom of that rope, and we get to the bottom of that rope and we know if we slip one more time, we're done. And we cry out to the one holding the rope, and miraculously, the rope gets a little longer. So you hang there some more, as the one at the top does the work. He does the work in His field, putting forth His effort to have it produce, and pulls you to the top, never leaving you, never forsaking you until you reach Him. Now you crest that summit, knowing that you face certain death, knowing that it was Him and His law that got you up there. And so you run to Him, the one that revealed the rope to you and gave you the grace each time you reached the end of it, and gave you the gift of the faith to let go of the branch. And you run to Him and you fall at His feet, thanking Him over and over and over again. This is the natural reaction. Your gratefulness cannot be contained. Your heart overflows. One has to admit that in that physical situation, about to die because you can't hold on there very long, and the rope was cast down to you and somebody pulled you to the top, the way that you would express that, honestly, is that you were saved by that person. The furthest thing from your mind would be to make sure that everyone acknowledged that you did the work of holding on to the rope. Even though you did. The fact is, your life was spared by a rope that you did not provide, was seen by faith that you did not provide, and pulled up with effort that you did not provide. Now, while it is true that you have to have faith that the rope was better than the branch, your work of faith, it's true that you had to hang on to the rope, gripping it harder each time you slipped from its cords of truth. Again, your works. And you can certainly hold fast to those works, to the truth of those statements, but I submit to you, as you ran to the one holding that rope that was provided with his own blood, the last thing you would say is, "Hey, didn't I do a great job holding on to that rope?" No one would do that. So while we do recognize that we have a part to play in responding to the work of Yeshua in our lives, at the end of the day, everything we work to produce in our lives is done in the field that God provides. Any good we do is done because the Word defines what good is. You wouldn't know what good is to do it unless for the law of God being revealed. We can't grab the rope of truth unless it's thrown to us and our eyes are open to it. The faith that we have to exercise to let go of our way of life, of surviving, to let go of that branch, to grab on the rope, that faith, the Word says, is a gift of God. Having that rope thrown over is nothing more than a gift that we receive. It's why it's grace. The true fact that we have to grab onto it is not the thing that one will proclaim when facing the one that provided it. The head says, "I grabbed the rope." Granted, true enough. But the heart says, "Thank you so much for tossing that down. Thank you for the sacrifice of your life so that you could be there to pull me up. The rope was yours. The effort to pull me up was yours. Yes, I hung on, but I give all the glory to you." And we need to be able to have grace in our theology that allows us to understand the heart of someone that says, "Yeshua did it all." Because that is what is overflowing in the heart. It's not the language of microtheology, it's the language of the heart. I submit to you that on the top of that cliff, the only thing on your mind would be thanking him for his wonderful work. We need to understand that when people give all the credit to Yeshua, that what they are doing is flowing from their heart. Myself and any pastor or teacher that acknowledges the rope, the law of God, and many do, they're not. Not everybody is done away with the law. We have our responsibility to grab on and live by it, but we will still come just short of saying, "You earn your salvation." Simply because, for no other reason than it does not serve to communicate the heart of the matter. We'll teach responsibility to hang on, but ultimately, and rightfully so, we'll communicate ultimate success to the work of Messiah. At the great Jubilee of Atonement, you will not be fed from the produce of a field that you cultivated. That bears repeating. At the great Jubilee of Atonement, you will not be fed from the produce of a field you cultivated. You will rest. You will be humbled to rely solely on what God provides to sustain you. It's the big lesson of the Jubilee. It's all God's land. It's all His resources. We are His workmanship in His field. All of this also speaks to something that I want to focus on in verse 10. We've already read it, but look again. You shall consecrate the 50th year and proclaim liberty throughout all the land to all its inhabitants. It shall be a jubilee for you, and each of you shall return to his possession, and each of you shall return to his family. I've highlighted the statement, proclaim liberty throughout all the land. Some versions say proclaiming freedom. Others say release throughout all the land. The word for freedom or liberty or release, depending on your translation, is the word D-E-R-O-R. This word is important because it is declaring for us exactly what the Jubilee is about. Up until very recently, it has been generally agreed by Jewish and Christian scholars that freedom and liberty were acceptable translations. And I got to kind of move along here quickly because there's a couple other things I want to handle. But I want to say that recently, in recent times, there have been more discoveries of manuscripts and stuff in the Akkadian language. The Akkadian language was the precursor to Hebrew. And so because Hebrew was a dead language that wasn't being spoken anymore, we get a lot of depth of meaning from the Akkadian language, and it has affected a lot of words, and this deror, D-E-R-O-R, is one of them. It comes from the Akkadian word, you pronounce that, Anduaru, okay? It was a legal term employed when a new king would come into power and declare forgiveness of debts and the release of indentured servants from their masters. A form of that word was also used that meant to move about freely. You can see that the words freedom and liberty kind of miss the point. Deror more corresponds to the concept of release, specifically as being released from bondage and from debts. Spiritually speaking, it's nail right on the head, doesn't it? So we're beginning to get this picture of Jubilee. One, that it's the second sabbatical year in a row for the Israelites. It happened twice in a century. And they couldn't, tend to the land. That it was a year of release of debts and land and servitude. The only food that could be eaten, whether by animals or men, was that which was stored away or that was sprouted up from old stalks. And so now we get another phrase whose meaning comes into better focus when we understand the release aspect of Jubilee. Leviticus 25:13 says, in this year of Jubilee, each of you shall return to his possession. Remember that this possession doesn't mean own. We possess it temporarily, like the house down the street. We're holding it. This is not a small detail, and it's crucial to understanding this, especially later as we move into the next testament at the back of the book and how this corresponds. We want to be clear that the Hebrew principle of this Azusa was that nobody owned the land. They just leased it for a time. And so the idea is that he holds it only as long as the lease, the lessor, allows him to, which is Yehovah. And so if he needs to use the land as collateral for a debt, then it's only for the period, like we've discussed, until the Jubilee. All right. So there was a lot of discussion by Yehovah in terms of how to handle those situations. And I'm running out of time, but you can read that in verses 14 through 22. I'm going to just skip over that. The gist is that ownership in the system only meant until the next Jubilee year. Okay, so we understand that in order to have this situation happen, that they would be counting the number of years and the number of crops that could be produced until the next jubilee, and that was the basis for its value. Secondarily, the labor that a person could do over that period of time. Point is, for the poor and those in debt at the jubilee, it was a great thing, something that they looked forward to. For the wealthy and the fortunate, it wasn't something they particularly liked. The jubilee for them was a loss. It meant a loss of a way that was gaining them wealth, loss of things that they had worked for in this world. And so it's easy to see the duality here. It's those that understand their debt of sin that dearly look forward to jubilee atonement, to get release from the grip of sin, that are grateful beyond words for the work of Yeshua to deliver them from this body of death. On the flip side, those that have the things of this world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life, desire to hold on to what they've achieved. They want to hold on to that branch, even though the rope is thrown over. Yeshua said it was easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for such a person to enter the kingdom of heaven. One more quick point and we'll close. I want you to look at 18 and 19. I've highlighted these here, that you shall observe my statutes and keep my judgments and perform them, and you will dwell in the land in safety. And the land will yield its fruit, and you will eat your fill and dwell there in safety. So they do what they're supposed to do, and he grants them productivity of the land and safety in the land. And I've highlighted this because this is really just a very wonderful, yet another verification of God's magnificent word. Because history proves... It just proves in a complete and astonishing way how this accurately played out in history. During the days of Israel, when they at least made an attempt to follow Yehovah, the land was miraculously productive. During the days when Israel were there in Bible times, all the surrounding, you know, the Babylonians, the Persians, the Romans show in their records how much these conquerors desired to have the benefit of all of these fabulous fruits and grains and vegetables that were produced in the land. But you contrast that, though, every single time the Israelites were exiled, each time, sure as God's word, the land stopped producing. When the Assyrians emptied the northern kingdom of Ephraim, Israel, and replaced them with foreigners, immediately the land went into distress. Nearly two centuries later, we read of the Jews returning from their captivity in Babylon to ruined fields, untended vineyards, and a destroyed Jerusalem. Over the centuries, the destruction of the temple by the Romans in 70 AD and the expulsion of the bulk of the Jewish people from the land, it began a steady decline that equally corresponded to the population balance of Israel and foreign people in the land. Eventually, Israel became a lightly populated place because it became almost a barren wasteland. Such contrast. History books are full of descriptions of visitors to the Holy Lands in the 18th, 19th, and 20th centuries. During an 1867 visit to Palestine, Mark Twain observed, and I quote, "Of all the lands there are for dismal scenery, Palestine must be the prince. The hills barren and dull, the valleys unsightly deserts inhabited by swarms of beggars with ghastly sores and malformations. There was hardly a tree or a shrub anywhere. Even the olive and the cactus, those fast friends of a worthless soil, had almost deserted the country. End quote. When Israel is not in the land responds by going fallow. And so today, now that they're back in the land, it's once again producing. When I came back from Israel, you've heard me say this over and over again. It's one of the things I talk about repeatedly because I was just astonished at the magnificent fruits and vegetables that were there. I've never seen fruit and vegetables so vibrant, nor tasted any so full of flavor. Indeed, God means what He says, and He says what He means. He owns everything and has power over it, and it performs His will. The lesson is, it's the same for us. You are bought with a price. The price was Yeshua's blood. He owns you. And if He owns you, you do His will. And that produce, those works, are His. Amen. I will say that there is more to this Jubilee chapter to unpack. So I'm going to reserve the right to come back to it another time. But for now, I will say to everyone, Shabbat Shalom. Love you all. And we'll hopefully see you all soon. Thank you.